Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Horace Lewis. I represent the appellant, Lou Lee, who was the defendant in a criminal case in the trial court. What happened in this case is that we had a powerful, far-reaching legal theory, perhaps one of the most far-reaching, that was discussed at length at the very beginning of the trial of the jury selection. It was discussed very forcefully, despite some caution by the trial. It went on for some length of time, talking about complicity, or aiding and abetting, or helplessness. This is so powerful, so broad-reaching. When I speak to students, or when I speak even to lawyers, I say, be careful who you choose as your friends. Because if you're out with them and they do something illegal, if you help in any way, or even encourage it, you could be liable for it. The jury believed that too. And the lawyers talked about it at length in this powerful, powerful legal concept that we understand. We have an instruction for. The juries may not totally understand it. Was drilled into them in the very jury selection process, and they were sworn to tell the truth, the jurors, and answer the questions truthfully. Do you agree that the person who drove in the bank robbery, even though they didn't go in the bank, is just as guilty of robbery? Then we go into a trial, and the issue becomes, who's the shooter? There's a car with two people in it. Mr. Lee is the driver. Horribly, shots were fired out here near I-25 in a busy intersection. A window was shattered, as you all know the facts. And the question became, who's the shooter? Who's the shooter? But the jury had this huge discussion in voir dire that both attorneys engaged in, and all the jurors bought into and agreed as part of their selection process. About you're the driver, you're guilty of the bank robbery.
Mr. Lewis, can I ask you, I guess I'm not quite clear on why it would have been improper for the prosecution to have raised that and focused on it in voir dire. I mean, at the time, I recognized they knew they had a witness who they expected was going to say he was the shooter. You know, have tried a lot of cases, witnesses sometimes go south on you. At the time, complicity was not out of the case. So I guess I'm not quite sure why it was improper for them to be talking about it at the time.
You know, I think the answer to your question is it may not be. I think both of us, respectfully, I don't speak as the Attorney General, both of us may have spent, and I did spend, too much time in my papers trying to say that it was improper. I don't think that we have to argue or you have to decide whether this is prosecutorial misconduct. And that's why I say this case doesn't fit into traditional, well-established claims. And if I implied that the prosecutor had some sinister motive, I apologize for that. It wasn't my intent. But as I say in the reply brief, when all of us start trying our case in voir dire, we do so at our peril. If we espouse a legal theory that we're not going to get an instruction on, we may have confused and misled that jury. So I think the answer is it may not have been prosecutorial misconduct in the traditional sense that we think of it.
Is it your perception that it affect the deliberations of the jurors, or that it affect the way they viewed the evidence as the evidence was presented, and in the way of thinking, it doesn't make any difference. We don't need to pay attention to who fired the gun. As long as there's evidence he was in the car, he's liable.
Yes, sir, just like the bank robber in the board hour discussions. That's my fear. And in a minute, there's some evidence to support that. But I think that's what happened.
Because the jury was instructed before they deliberated, they were to decide it based upon these instructions, and there was no complicity instruction.
Right, which almost makes it even more confusing, because the jury has talked about and bought into and accepted in voir dire this rather complex legal theory, and they're not instructed on what it is, to what it applies, or how it applies. They're sort of left, as some of the cases I gave you, which aren't on point, because there aren't any on point. To speculate, what does this mean? This bank robbery driver, this driver, what if the other guy shot at that car that those little children were in? Then Mr. Lee is guilty too, just like the bank robbery driver. So I think the answer to your question is yes. So, I think they didn't have any guidance. It wasn't anybody's fault. It's just the way it happened.
Mr. Lewis, I think I understand the argument you're making, but let me run it by you and make sure, and please do tell me if you think I have it wrong. I think your position is that we know the jury decided based on complicity, because that's the only way to square the verdicts that they reached, And I think you're also saying that the jury necessarily found that, that Mr. Lee was not the shooter. Am I right about that? All right. Well, let me follow up then on that to see if, in fact, I know this is not it's an inconsistent verdict case in its usual sense, but let me address that for a minute. 1812.107.5 requires not only that the defendant shot the gun, but also that he did so into an occupied motor vehicle. And I guess question for you is, couldn't the jury have had a reasonable doubt here on the second question? In other words, they could have thought Mr. Lee was a shooter, but weren't sure that the gun that he shot into a vehicle. Now, they were instructed into a vehicle without any further guidance, and I know there's law that says into could mean, you know, bounced off the vehicle, but there were no bullets in the car. The cops all testified, you know, well, we look, we didn't see any slugs in there, anything else. I'm not sure, were asked by defense counsel at trial, you know, couldn't have been some other foreign object, you know, or a ricochet or something. Couldn't the jury have said, well, we think Mr. Lee shot this gun. We're not so convinced he shot into a car, or at least we have a reasonable doubt about it. Acquit on that and convict on all the others. Wouldn't that be a way to square the verdict?
I don't think it would be, because as you recall from the record, the window was shattered, the back window in the car, right in the direction in which the shots were fired. And as you may also recall, there was some evidence near the scene, some physical evidence. Mm-hmm. So I don't see that a jury could reasonably, in terms of legally, reasonably, and logically, conclude that it was a shot in a car. And again, that offense, that unlawful discharge of a firearm, we'll recall is not only knowingly, but or recklessly.
Right.
So shooting even in the direction of the car, if it hit the car recklessly, would be that unlawful discharge of a firearm. I understand if this is an inconsistent verdict argument, traditional one I lose 10 minutes ago. It's not, but you know what this is? I went back to Aristotle. I did, Judge Dahl. and his
You made him nervous.
And so the major premise would be, in Aristotle's source, the major premise would be, without complicity, jury would have to find that Mr. Lee was the shooter. Major premise, everybody can accept that. The minor premise would be that on the verdict of the unlawful discharge of the firearm, this is the trigger man. There's no confusion on this. This is the trigger man. You shot or you did. It's who pulled the trigger. It wasn't two hands on the trigger, one finger. So the minor premise is, by their verdict on that, they found that Mr. Lee was not the shooter. He didn't unlawfully discharge the firearm. There's only one gun. The conclusion in Aristotle's syllogism is that they found the guilty verdicts on the other counts as a conclusion.
Mr. Lewis, I like that, by the way. Could I ask you the converse kind of question? Could the jury have found here that Mr. Lee did not fire the gun and still convicted him of the various attempted murder and attempted assault charges? As you know, attempt requires a substantial step and whatever else. I'm just kind of curious in your view on that stat, on the attempt statute, whether the jury could have said, I think it was an attempt because of the car chase or whatever else, but I don't think he shot the gun. Could you square it that way?
It would still have to be under complicity, though. I suppose you could say that driving the car, I think, if I understand your question, even if the gun were never shot, right?
Yes.
Driving the car, chasing this person down the highway at a high rate of speed would be a substantial step toward commission of the
crime. Right. Substantial, the statute, as you well know, is a substantial step strongly corroborative of the firmness of the actor's purpose to complete the commission of the offense. And I'm just curious as to whether the jury could have concluded here Mr. Lee didn't fire the gun. Maybe it was the passenger fired the gun, but I think he made a substantial step strongly corroborative of the mens rea on the attempted murder charge and the attempted assault charges.
Yes.
Okay. You think that they could have done that?
Theoretically, yes.
Okay.
But since the gun was shot, and that's what everyone was talking about through the trial, while I think that's theoretically possible, I think it's legally possible. I don't think it's a logical interpretation of what happened in this trial. And so if we look at that minor premise, that verdict on the illegal discharge of a firearm, that's what everybody was focused on. And that's what the cross-examination was about. That's what the testimony was about. He shot it. I had no idea he was going to do it. He had a broken window with children in the back of the car. And so I don't think they sliced that thinly, Judge Gabriel. I think that this jury was more concerned with who shot the gun. And it's likely, under a plain error analysis, I think it's reasonably possible that this interjection of this complicity theory into the trial at the very outset resulted in unreliable verdicts.
Mr. Lewis, it seems to me that in this case, the district attorney had a good faith belief at the outset of the trial for believing that there was going to be a basis for a complicity instruction, because if I remember correctly, the DA actually asked for a complicity instruction before the case went to the jury. So isn't it appropriate then for the jury to consider complicity or to be asked questions about complicity in those circumstances?
I'm not saying it was sinister, and I don't think this case fits in traditional concepts of prosecutorial misconduct, because I'm not suggesting that it was intentional. I'm saying he should have known what his witness was going to say. I said that in the briefs. But I'm not thinking this is a traditional sinister prosecutorial overreaching misconduct. And yes, Judge, they usually do get that instruction in these cases. He may well have thought he's going to get it. But as I say in the reply brief, when we do that, we do so at our peril. And the realities are, for the three of you, it got introduced into the trial. And you may not have to decide whether it was right, wrong, or indifferent. It was in there. And the verdicts suggest that it had its effect, and that its effect was to produce very unreliable verdicts. I'll reserve, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve any time.
You have 3 minutes and 15 seconds, Mr. Lewis.
Thanks.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Crane. I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. Attorney registration number is 37842. Judges, the facts of this case are fairly simple. And as Mr. Lewis concedes, the jury was very aware that the question was, who is the shooter in this case? The parties argued that, and that was essentially all the parties argued in closing. So the jury was not wondering at that point if the case turned on. Well, the jury at that point certainly knew that the issue was, who is the shooter? And there was plenty of evidence at trial to support the conclusion that the defendant was the shooter. There was testimony that the defendant regularly carried a handgun in his car. There was testimony that the defendant, not his passenger, had a grudge against the man that they were trying to shoot, and who the defendant, who was the driver of the car, was following from one auto parts store to another, while the intended target's mother was driving that car. And again, in closing argument, both of the lawyers debated, was the evidence clear that the defendant was the shooter? That's what the jury was called upon to decide.
And it appears that they decided the defendant wasn't the shooter, or I guess I'd be interested to hear your argument on how do they acquit on the illegal discharge of a firearm.
Well, the defendant's argument is built on his assertion that the illegal discharge of a firearm count is the determinative question of who was the person who pulled the trigger. That's what his argument is built on. If that falls, I'm not familiar with Aristotle, but if that premise falls, I think the rest of the argument falls apart. So the problem is, illegal discharge of a firearm, it does not call upon the jury to just decide who pulled the trigger. It's a crime with elements just like any other crime. And as I mentioned in my answer brief, first of all, it's subject to complicity theory, just like any other crime. So I don't know why defense counsel reads complicity into the other jury verdicts, but not into this one. But even setting that aside, illegal discharge of a firearm has elements, which the court has already pointed out. Illegal discharge of a firearm is committed when a person knowingly or recklessly fires a gun into a vehicle. Now, in this case, the evidence was that the defendant pointed a gun out the sunroof and fired a gun three times in the direction of their intended target's vehicle. the vehicle that was actually hit, whether it was by bullets or by ricochet, was in front of that vehicle somewhere. And so there wasn't evidence that established whether or not the defendant knew that that other vehicle was somewhere in front of that other car. His vision may have been blocked. He may not have been paying attention. And the jury, therefore, could have reached the conclusion that the defendant, by firing the gun, was attempting to knowingly kill the man driving the car that he was shooting at, while at the same time acting with extreme indifference with respect to the mother and the three children of the car of which the windows were blown out. And the jury could have determined that instead of the defendant knowingly or recklessly firing into that mother's car, it was either ricochet from the bullets that went, or concrete that had blown off the freeway, the bullets hit the freeway, or they could have determined that he didn't know that that car was there in the first place, and so he could not knowingly or have recklessly disregarded the risk he would shoot into another vehicle.
So I guess I get the second part because I raised that with Mr. Lewis, and, sure. And that was not in your brief, I don't think. You have raised the mens rea argument, and forgive me, Mr. Crane, but I'm just not sure I'm following it, and so it may be me. So well, you might need to try me again because the firearm statute talks about knowingly or recklessly. I can understand if you're focused on the mens rea, okay, didn't knowingly shoot into a car, shot, you know, at a minimum it would seem to be reckless. You seem to be arguing that the jury could have somehow rejected recklessness that the defendant didn't prove, prosecution didn't prove recklessness by beyond a reasonable doubt. But I have trouble squaring that with the attempt charges where they had to extreme indifference, and I don't know how they would convict of one and find not reckless on the other. And so maybe you can explain that to me because I'm not following it.
Sure. Extreme indifference murder is committed when someone under circumstances, and it's a long definition, but I have to read it to explain what the theory is. Extreme indifference murder is committed when under circumstances evidencing an attitude of universal malice, manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life generally, knowingly engages in conduct that creates a grave risk of death to a person or persons other than himself. That could have been attempted in this case by the defendant simply firing a gun out of a sunroof on the freeway when you know that there's other people in the general vicinity. It's a public place. However, recklessness, conduct is reckless when a person consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that a result will occur. The jury could have found that the defendant did not recklessly fire into that third vehicle because either he didn't know it was there, and so he was not conscious of the risk that he would hit another vehicle, or his firing was not such that it created a substantial risk that when he fired at vehicle number two, he might have hit vehicle number three, because it might not have been the bullets that shot out the windows of the third car. It might have been a ricochet off asphalt on the freeway or a bullet fragment.
Mr. Crane, do you think that the illegal discharge of a firearm acquittal is inconsistent with the other offenses of which Mr. Lee was convicted under the People v. Frye case?
Do I think that the verdicts of guilt and acquittal are logically inconsistent?
Yes.
No, I don't think they are, and that's what I wanted to clarify with Judge Gabriel. Specifically, the illegal discharge of a firearm was the only acquittal.
Well, in the Frye case, if I remember correctly, the Supreme Court said that a jury could reach factually inconsistent verdicts, but that there were certain exceptions for legally inconsistent verdicts. So I gather your position is that the verdicts here might have been factually inconsistent, but not legally inconsistent?
I don't even think that the jury had to reach factually inconsistent conclusions to support the acquittal and the conviction. I think the jury could have found that the defendant shot the gun up the car and it was directed in such a way, or he did it in such a way, that it did not constitute illegal discharge of the firearm with respect to that third vehicle, whereas it did constitute extreme indifference.
But does it have to be with respect to the third vehicle? If you fire into traffic blindly, wouldn't that be reckless as a matter of law?
Well, you know, I think that's a good, that sort of raises a transferred intent question almost, I think. And that was never argued or brought up at trial, whether in jury selection or otherwise. And so I would doubt that the jury, I think it would require a lot of even more speculation to gather that the jury would have applied some kind of a theory like that. Whether or not that could apply in this case, I'm not really sure. It was never raised. And so I haven't had a chance to think about it very, very, very much.
Mr. Crane, I can ask you, like to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Lewis. Could the jury here have convicted, and you may have just answered this, but I want to make sure. Could the jury have convicted on the attempt charges if it found that Mr. Lee was not the shooter?
Under a complicity theory?
No, under not complicity theory. In other words, so complicity is not in the case. There's no issue about complicity. Could the jury here have convicted on the attempted murder and attempted assault charges after concluding, and this is an assumption you'd have to make, concluding that Mr. Lee did not fire that gun? Say they concluded the passenger did, not Mr. Lee. Could they still have convicted of the attempt charges?
I'm not sure how you, oh, I see what you're saying.
It would be one way to square the verdicts. That's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah, I suppose they could. I hadn't even thought about it that way, but I suppose they could in the sense that his driving and following this other vehicle and then positioning his vehicle and turning at a certain time could be viewed as
extreme indifference or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's. I think it requires a little bit more, several more steps of reasoning than some of the other answers. But I think maybe that's possible. Yes.
And I'm sorry, I keep asking too many questions, probably. But do you have a view personally as to whether the jury concluded whether Mr. Lee was the shooter? Just I recognize it's just your opinion. But do you think the jury can reject it or concluded Mr. Lee was not the shooter based on their verdict?
Well, I think probably I shouldn't speak except on behalf of the Attorney General's office, but it seems to me, and I really do think it's true, that the closing arguments made it very, very clear for the jury that the question was Mr. Lee the shooter or was he not? After reading through those closing arguments, it just seems crystal clear to me that that was what they were going to decide. And when you've got defense counsel out there arguing, no, it was the passenger who was the shooter, for them to say, you know, for them to then believe that it didn't even matter, that would make no sense.
So you would, I guess, I know you're speaking for the Attorney General. I didn't mean to make that personal.
No,
so at least from your perception, you think that the jury found a reasonable doubt as to whether Mr. Lee was the shooter?
The jury found a reasonable doubt?
Do you think that the jury acquitted on that charge? So. They could have acquitted because they thought the bullet didn't go into the car. I'm just curious now, who is it, in terms of the trigger man, is it your view on behalf of the Attorney General that the jury decided Mr. Lee was not the person who pulled the trigger?
No, I think they decided he was the one.
All right, so the basis for the acquittal on the illegal discharge was the other issues you raised, that maybe they didn't have the find the mens rea or, okay, all right, thank you.
Got the interrogatories also, which I think may, when a jury is answering a verdict form, it's very clear they're finding whether or not certain legal elements have been found, whereas when you have an interrogatory, it's viewed as a factual determination by the jury. And so because the jury also had to answer those special interrogatories with respect to crime of violence, whether or not the defendant possessed or threatened or used a deadly weapon in commission of the offense, I think that further supports the jury very well, very clearly believed it was the defendant.
Although the jury did not have to conclude he was the trigger man to actually answer yes on those interrogatories. As you just said, the interrogatories talked about possession or use, or attempted use, I think. Okay.
Could be viewed that way, I agree.
Thank you.
The court has no further questions. Thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Crane.
I think the logic of this case cries out to us. And the difficulty, perhaps, is getting past fraud. It's not a fraud case. I'm not asking for judgment of acquittal on those other counts. Did you know this from the brief? As I would be asking in an inconsistent jury. I'm asking for a new trial because the jury was misled. Intentionally or not. Bottom line is they were. And the only logical conclusion is that they convicted on those serious counts that sent Louis to prison for 98 years on a complicity theory, but not even one that was properly charged by the court. A theory that was discussed in the street terms when we were done.
Well, that gets me to the question I was going to ask you at the close of your first argument. Okay. How is this inconsistent? How is it necessary that the jury determined that he had to have fired the rounds for the unlawful discharge of a weapon, but not for the other?
Well, under a complicity theory, he wouldn't have had to fire the rounds at all. The gun could have been fired by the other person who was in the car, and just like in the robbery analogy.
I know, but how are these offenses different in terms of the jury's conclusion as to who discharged the weapon?
Because the other instructions and the other crimes, as Judge Gabriel pointed out, are under used or possessed or threatened to use a much broader definition. I believe the count that really matters in the minor premise in our syllabus is the unlawful discharge of the firearm, because it is clear you unlawfully discharged the firearm, knowingly or recklessly. I think that's the only count that really gets to the heart of the case. And indeed, Judge Roy, if everyone argued, everyone knew that the issue was who pulled the trigger, Judge Roy, that's the count that would have decided. And it did decide it. And it decided that Mr. Lee was not that man. It's the only logical conclusion. It's not a Fry case. Maybe it's some sort of hybrid judge talk. I don't know. A jury can come to logically inconsistent verdicts. The uncommon denominator, the extra factor that we have in this case, is the interjection of this powerful, overreaching legal theory without proper instructions from the court, and which was improperly considered by the jury. That's what separates the problem. And that's what makes the verdict on the unlawful discharge of the firearm so important in the logical analysis of what happened.
I know your time's about up here, Mr. Lewis, but I guess I'll ask the question that's screaming out here. Why aren't you asking us to speculate about what the jury did here? You say the jury had to have decided on complicity. The many, many cases, Fry included, say really, as a court, can't speculate on the juror's thought processes. And so why aren't we being asked to speculate here?
To some extent, perhaps you are. I suppose anytime we try to explain a jury verdict, there's some degree of speculation that's inherent in that. This is not like a Fry case, though, where we're being asked to speculate just on the verdicts themselves. Remember, we have that extra component in this case, that powerful component that tells us what the jury probably did. It makes it truly logical. So to some extent, yes, perhaps so. That may be inherent. But not the sheer speculation that was condemned by Fry. This is a different case. It's a really, I think, interesting and unusual and unique case, and I commend you and leave it with you in the wisdom of Aristotle.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. We appreciate your argument, particularly the reference to Aristotle. Mr. Crane, we appreciate your argument as well. That concludes the oral argument in this case. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. As